So, yes, my name's Angie, and you may have noticed already I've got a funny accent. Scottish. Yeah, well, unfortunately not. I haven't mastered in any way the Tibetan language, but I hope everyone can understand okay. I try to slow it down. I've been in America for some years now, so the nice thing is that people really like the Scottish accent, but they don't always pick it up in the beginning, you know, so try and keep it a little bit slower, because we tend to speak very quickly and drop many vowels and consonants on words, so it becomes difficult for people to understand, but it's still English per se, you know. It's like the lazy person's English almost, because we can speak so quickly because many letters get dropped off. So how are we doing so far? Anybody? No, okay, good. Anyway, I'm replacing another nun, Venerable Dreamy. She's probably spoken here before.
No, she hasn't.
She hasn't. Oh, okay. She asked me to replace her a couple of weeks ago because her father became unwell, and then unfortunately he passed away. So she's a member of Land of Medicine Buddha, and we're you know, sister sangha who serve in the same organisation. So it's very nice to be here. It's a beautiful place. Very refreshing. And I was like, wow, I thought the Tibetan tradition was full of ceremony. I thought we were the ones who'd all the ceremony. And then I got here and Reverend Kokyo was like, and then you come in and you go right here and you do this and you go here. And I'm like, well, really? I thought we were the ones that had all these prostrations. And so anyway, it's very nice to see a lot of, you know, ritual. I really enjoy and love ritual anyway. I think I didn't quite get everything fitted in there, but it's I really appreciate ritual. So that was very enjoyable to be able to participate in that. Because as many as you know, I think in our tradition, how many of you here actually have been to Land of Medicine Buddha or Vajrapani? So you can see, I mean, so many holy objects. And we also do many prostrations, there's many rituals and offerings. And that's actually a large part of my practice of, you know, since the discussion tonight is about devotion, and you've been doing some, that's been your topic for the year, I guess, on devotion, so maybe you've had some different speakers. So certainly in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I mean, devotion is what we call the root or the foundation of the path, you know, and I think really it's the case in all the Buddhist traditions. It's just somehow a different format, maybe somehow. So our expression, a devotion, is expressed in many ways, but in a very particular way, through the relationship with the spiritual teacher. So as you know, it's quite when we go into these meditation places, you know, Land of Medicine Buddha, Vajrapani, we have all these images of, you know, not only Buddha, but many, many other deities, and also many pictures of spiritual teachers there as well. And this is particularly coming from the Vajrayana teachings, this relationship that we have to cultivate with the spiritual teacher, and also, you know, having the presence of all these different deity practices is coming mainly from in the Tibetan tradition, Vajrayana or tantric practice. So the practice really, when I first met Tibetan Buddhism, you know, this, what I was introduced to, first of all, I think where a devotion has to start, even in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, is with the teachings, what the Buddha taught, in terms of the techniques to transform our minds. And even within Zen, within the Tibetan tradition, you know, there's all these different methods according to our mental capability and our inclination. The Buddha kindly taught unbelievable amount of methods, you know. So the Vajrayana teachings, the practice of Tantra, which again has to be based on the you know, other practices, sutric practices, they're taught alongside. The emphasis for these teachings is very much developing quite a close relationship with a spiritual teacher. Because in that practice, we have to receive empowerments, we have to do these long daily commitments, generate some kind of relationship with all these deities that we see hanging in the gompa, you know, which all embody enlightened consciousness, enlightened mind. But there's a particular method in the Vajrayana. We were developing this devotion towards a spiritual teacher who's going to awaken all these qualities within ourselves. So it's not necessarily, you know, we're not trying to achieve some different enlightenment by any means, but this apraxia devotion is very much, once we understand the basic teachings, I mean, once we develop this wish within ourselves to at least, enlightenment's a kind of far-off goal, but at least wanting to change our mind from negative states of mind to positive states of mind, then we're encouraged in our tradition to start developing a relationship with a spiritual teacher who somehow is able to, if they have, you know, from their side having certain qualities, can help to move our path along quicker. So one time, maybe to give some example of that, one time I went to a teaching with His Holiness. Has anyone been to any teachings with His Holiness the Dalai Lama? Yeah. So His Holiness is very kind, and he always opens up questions, you know, at the end of his teachings usually. So people are right to write down things and give the questions to the translator. And I remember one of the questions was, you know, do we need a teacher on the spiritual path? Can we not just rely on the texts and the commentaries? Would that not be enough? And His Holiness said, of course, you can achieve enlightenment and all the qualities through the texts and your own study. And he said, but if you have a teacher, it'll go faster. So, you know, there wasn't an either or per se. It's just if you want to develop a bit more quicker, the answer is so, and it says we would have a teacher. And I think it's similar in any any kind of thing that we want to develop, anything in your life. If you just studying for the text is wonderful, still wonderful, and you'll get somewhere. But if you have a teacher who embodies the qualities of what you're trying to develop, would you agree? You're going to develop more quickly. And on top of that, if you have some devotion, or what's that, what could be another expression? What other words? You must have come across maybe other words for devotion when you've been doing this topic. Respect.
Dedication.
Dedication's a very good one. Commitment. So this is actually, I feel, in some level, better expression than devotion. Sometimes devotion can bring this, you know, when you go move into faith or worship, it can be something a little bit more, not so tangible. And it could potentially, we could go off in some, you know, it kind of feels like devotion to this person, or, you know, it can have some problems, that word. And actually the way His Holiness the Dalai Lama teaches is very, very grounded and practical, so he very rarely uses the word devotion. He often uses the word confidence, appreciation. So for ourselves in this tradition, what I've realised over years is, yes, even when we're practising in this path and we have this particular way we were trying to meet a spiritual teacher who has a certain quality who can benefit us, what really stands the test of time with what we call in this tradition your guru devotion practice is your commitment to this teachings. Your commitment, your dedication to want to change your mind from something unwholesome to all the wholesome qualities. So that's been my experience. I was very attracted to the practice of devotion, and I found that I was very fortunate. I had a lot of faith in the teachings when I first met them. But the hardships, whether you have a teacher or not, those of us who have been practicing for some time, or not maybe even for a while, you know, there's many hardships in our spiritual path. So what I found is the way you really get through your hardships is your dedication to the path, to your teachings, and your sincerity to want to keep changing your mind and moving it along in the path to enlightenment. So that's what really actually is, for me, what holds this relationship with my spiritual teacher. I mean, my own dedication, and also, of course, from the side of the teacher, their particular qualities to be able to hold you and move you through these challenges and difficulties. Is this making some sense? I feel in some way, I said to Reverend Kokyo, It's quite a big topic, and I don't know how well I'm going to express it in about half an hour or something, you know, because it's a very huge part of the Tibetan Buddhist practice, you know, how we develop in our mind in devotion towards a spiritual teacher and what that really is. It's difficult to express in a few words, but and then not only just from my side, but also from the side of who, you know, when we say devote to a spiritual teacher, I mean, who, you know, it's not just any spiritual teacher. It's also from, in that particular practice, we need to take some time, you know, we're encouraged to take quite some time to actually choose a particular teacher that you feel you want to sort of dedicate your practice towards, your service towards, and in many cases your life effort towards that, you know. So this holiness often encourages us, because in this Vajrayana tradition, you know, there is definitely the emphasis there, but His Holiness will often encourage people in this tradition to take up to 12 years to choose their spiritual teacher. Because once you've chosen that teacher, you take initiation, you take empowerment, you take special teachings, you can't decide later, I think there's something wrong with that teacher, you know, I see that he's, you know, his ethics aren't so great, or I don't think he has as much patience or compassion. Your mind might start to change, but you've already made that spiritual commitment. So there's some, you know, of course there's a great power in finding this spiritual teacher and dedicating your practice towards that with some dedication. But there's also these drawbacks that we need to be aware of, and take quite some time in this tradition to choose our teachers. I felt incredibly fortunate because I met Lama Zopa Rinpoche. I didn't have an instant enlightened experience with my teacher in it by any means. I had to go away and do quite some purification. But because Lama Zopa Rinpoche is so well known in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, has anyone heard of Lama Zopa Rinpoche? I mean, if you've visited the centres, you'll know that he's the director. He's very well known, so he has an incredibly good reputation among, there's four different schools in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and among all the schools he has a very, very high reputation. So I didn't have to take 12 years to decide that he was going to be my teacher. But there are some teachers who have fewer disciples and they practice in solitary places. So for that reason, His Holiness says we need to take some time to check up the spiritual teacher before we really start to engage in this practice of what we call in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition guru yoga or guru devotion, where you really are in reality, if one really wants to develop our mind kind of in that specific way in the spiritual path through practicing sutra and tantra, you have to practice starting with giving some of your possessions, then you start to offer service, then you start to, you know, deepen your practice through receiving empowerments. And so this is, in this way, how the practice goes. Whether you're a monk or nun or not, my teacher, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, has many lay students who serve the organisation. That's their life, you know, as I'm sure you do in this organisation as well. So when you go to our centres, there's many lay students there that they've given up their sort of life to serve in a particular way, to fulfil the wishes in my, you know, of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, which means serving that centre in that particular place and those people in that particular place in a specific way for their spiritual development. So, yeah, so it's for myself personally, the practice of, you know, I feel very fortunate to have met Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and I feel very fortunate to have met this tradition, that I feel over the years, this method of relying on a spiritual teacher, we call it guru devotion, or relying on a spiritual teacher to sort of guide you through your path. My teacher uses this analogy, it's like the guru, or the spiritual teacher, is like someone who's holding a rope. You're stuck down the bottom of this well. This deep dark hole or well, you know, that's very dark, and that's the analogy of us being in samsara, cyclic existence. We're here and we can't quite see things, we're kind of lost in a way, in our confusion. And the guru or the spiritual teacher is like someone who's at the top of this hole holding a rope. And it's up to you if you want to hold on. So when you first meet the teacher, you might be down there and you can hear a voice saying, here's the rope, you know, if you just go this way, you'll kind of grab hold, you know. And then, but when you sort of enter in a relationship, it's like grabbing, you've decided you're going to take hold of that rope. You have some trust that that person up there is going to be able to pull you out, you know. And then, however, when you get up there, there can still be quite a lot of hurdles in getting up through the hole, you know, so because you're still in the dark. You don't quite know where you're going, you know. So, I mean, there's many analogies like that, but I particularly like that one because it's this analogy, this, you know, special being who has already reached the light, who's pulling you out of the darkness into the light, but you still can't quite figure out for many times where you're supposed to be going. So there is definitely a level of trust and faith in that, which I think we all have either way in our spiritual practice. But again, as His Holiness says, the trust and faith comes through the confidence that you've been through some hurdles and that worked. So hopefully the next hurdle that you go through, this mirror of the Guru, will continue through His compassion for you, for ourselves, and our own dedication, our own commitment, will continue to keep pulling us up through till we achieve the higher states of kind of happiness up to enlightenment. Maybe before I open up to questions, I can share. At the moment, I work at Lama Zopa Rinpoche's house. He has a residence here in California, and he's had it about 20 years. We have many centres around, as you know, Vajrapani, Land of Medicine Buddha. We have a centre in San Jose called Ocean of Compassion. We have a centre in San Francisco called Sechenling. And then, I mean, although Lama Zopa Rinpoche travels around most of the time, about 20 years ago, the students gathered together and bought him a residence here, because he was spending quite some time here. So I'm serving there at the moment, and again, my practice is very ritual-based, water bowl offerings, cleaning the house. We have something like 250 water bowls that we offer every day. I think some of you came to do animal liberation practice. Was anyone else here came at that time? No. I wasn't there at the time, but I heard that you, was it Venerable Dreamy that brought you there? And
various people.
Yeah, yeah. Worms, yeah. So we have, I'll maybe show that at the end as well, but we have, anyway, the house has many, many different offerings that we make every day. The Sangha there, there's two monks and two nuns, and we do various offerings, including 250 water bowl offerings every day. It's to generate what we call merit or energy for this, the organisation. Lama Zopa Rinpoche has many, many projects, so we create what we call merit, or you familiar with the term merit? Yeah, you use the term merit? To generate everything we need for all the different projects, and it seems to have that effect. So that's my main practice of service there. But I wanted to share maybe from the Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist tradition, one example of a Tibetan Buddhist saint called Milarepa. You've read their life story? Or you've heard about Milarepa? He's like, in our tradition, he's like one of the best examples of this practice of relying on a spiritual teacher, having devotion towards your spiritual teacher, which in that life actually led him to achieve enlightenment in that life. And you can buy, this is one of the first books I myself read when I met Tibetan Buddhism, and I think it's one of the first books that all the Tibetan Buddhists read, because it's so inspiring how he practiced what we call guru devotion or guru yoga. So just briefly to go over his life story, he was born in Tibet in around the, I think, 12th century, something like that. And he was born to quite a wealthy family. His father was a merchant. So up until about the age of 7 or 8, I mean, his family experienced very comfortable, prosperous life. And then at that age, his father passed away. So traditionally, all the wealth was given to the father's brother. And the father's brother was married and he had children. So his mother, himself, and he had a sister as well, were now under, you know, they had to be taken care by the uncle. Well, he became the uncle, Milarepa's uncle. So the uncle had promised to his brother, Milarepa's father, he would take care of the family, and when Milarepa achieved his, you know, became of age, 16 or 18, he would receive all the wealth of his father. However, the uncle didn't live up to his promise, so the family, that Milarepa, his sister and mother, were left in abject, they were left in poverty for years. They were given nothing. The uncle was extremely cruel. And so, and none of the villagers, they lived in a small village, none of the villagers helped. They all supported the uncle because he had the money. So the mother generated a huge amount of, you know, hatred towards the uncle because they were in so much, you know, they were living with rags. They had hardly any food. It was incredible difficult circumstances. When Milarepa achieved his age, 16, 18, the mother got all the resources she could and had a party in the village. But still the uncle refused to give all the resources, all the family resources back to the Milarepa and his mother. So the mother asked Milarepa to go and study black magic because she wanted to have revenge on the uncle and aunt. So he went off to this great master at the time in Tibet who was, you know, who studied black magic, and he achieved certain powers because he was already quite a spiritual person. Maybe he didn't, I guess the mother noticed that. So he was able to develop some special powers quite quickly. And then the mother wrote to him and said, there's going to be a big gathering because the aunt and uncle, their child, son or daughter, are going to get married. So please come and create a huge storm on that day and destroy the wedding. So Milarepa came back. There's a movie out, actually, this, but the whole movie's unfortunately only did half of the story. The second half's the most juicy. This is the first half. But anyway, Milarepa came back and he sat on a mountain some distance and he created this huge storm and killed 35 people at the gathering. He caused all the buildings to fall down and 35 of the villagers were killed. The aunt and uncle weren't killed, and the mother said to him, you know, she didn't particularly want those, she wanted them to suffer by still being the ones that were alive, but knowing that Milarepa had done this to the family. So, I mean, Milarepa was like 20 or something, he was very young, and he was, you know, he had this devotional nature, so he wanted his mother to be happy, so he went off and he did these things, and later regretted it, that he killed 35 people. So he left this, he said, came back to his guru who had studied black magic from and says, I'm completely devastated. I have huge regret that I did this now. What can I do? He said, I want to, you know, Milarepa decided, he really wanted to purify his mind. And he also, you know, he decided that he wanted to train his mind in the path to enlightenment. That's really what he wanted to do with the gifts he had this life. So this black magic guru says, well, you can go to this very powerful master called Marpa. And he will help you with this. I can't help you. This has been my path, but this great master will help you. So even some of the black magic, the disciples of the black magic master didn't want to go to Marpa because they knew he was a very, very powerful guru. They were afraid almost because they were using some of their powers for sort of negative ends, you know. Anyway, Milarepa did, you know, he walked quite far and arrived at Marpa's place and begged him, that, you know, told him what he'd done and begged him that he needed to purify this karma. He felt huge regret and to accept him as disciple, and Marpa accepted. So Marpa at that time was one of the, I mean, he still is one of the main lineage masters of many of the precious teachings in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition coming from the Buddha. So Marpa put Milarepa through unbelievable hardship to purify his karma. I mean, something we couldn't, I mean, myself, you know, I'm at my teacher's house filling some water bowls and cleaning the house. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, Marpa was a great guru. He had a huge compassion, but he had just killed 35 people. So the karma was so heavy, you know. So he caused him to build three towers on his own, carrying the bricks, putting them there. I think one time he built the tower, some man was passing. So he asked this man to help him, just put one stone there. When the tower was finished, Marpa came over and said, you have to take the tower down again. And he pointed to this stone, because he knew that he hadn't done it all on his own. He had asked one person to help him one day. So, things like this, you know, he put him through unbelievable. And the third tower he built was a 9-story tower, which you can still go. It's a pilgrimage place in Tibet now. You can go there just to rejoice in the dedication and devotion in Milarepa, you know. And not just that, he never gave him one syllable of teaching. He only caused him to work, and he wouldn't give him any teachings. He was like a really, really tough guru, you know. But actually, he loved Milarepa. Milarepa became his closest heart disciple. So he did this for something like 12 years. And each time he said, told him to take down the tower, he says, you build the next one, then I'll give you some teaching. Meantime, he had all these other disciples coming. They would sit and he'd give them nice teachings. And a couple of times, Milarepa came, just sneaked into the teaching. Marpa beat him up and kicked him out. So, I mean, I think there's no way I could be able to cope with that, you know. But anyway, Milarepa stayed for like something like 10, 12 years. Eventually gave up, went to another master, had no experiences in meditation. And the other master then, he told the master, actually my guru was Marpa. And that master says, you need to go back to that other guru. I don't have the karma connection with you. So he took him back to his other guru. So he went back to Marpa. And then Marpa eventually agreed to give teachings, you know. But actually, Marpa, what we look at this is it was his skillful means to purify his negative karma. I mean, he killed 35 people, you know, in that life. Yet, Milarepa was seeking to achieve enlightenment that life. So it's kind of, you know, how do you, as a spiritual teacher, this is how Marpa was trying very quickly to purify his karma. So he gave him many teachings, and then Milarepa went off and meditated in the mountains under very ascetic conditions, eating nettles and not having many, you know, any resources really. And he achieved very, very high, you know, he achieved enlightenment in that life. So it was a period of about 25 years where he was dedicating about 12 years doing all this hard work, and then another 12 years where he went off into meditation. He ate so many nettles that he turned green. So you actually see, sometimes you see pictures of Milarepa, because he's, you know, he's really the most famous practitioner, lineage master for us, because, as I say, this practice of guru devotion. You'll see many pictures of him hanging a gompa just with a white cloth, because he studied, he just practiced with this very one white cloth. Repa means the cotton clad one, because he only wore one simple cloth, and he sustained himself from nettles over 12 years in, you know, isolated places in Tibet. And then when he achieved enlightenment, you know, we can read all these songs of realization that he's written, many volumes of spirit. He used to go around at villages and teach in poetry and through singing and songs. So that's what we have from his life, his spiritual songs, as well as this unbelievable practice of devotion, you know. So every time I have a little bit of hardship, maybe with my devotional practice, I think it's nothing compared to Milarepa, you know. I'm not out there, I'm not getting kicked out of teachings by my guru, I'm not getting asked to build 9-story towers where his back was like raw. He was having these huge blisters on his back for the effort he put in. But because he had so much dedication, his teacher could put him through that. That was the whole point, you know. He was so dedicated because he wanted to achieve enlightenment. He wanted to purify that karma, and on top of that, he wanted to achieve enlightenment. So for me, that's like, it's, something to rejoice, amazing. We're often encouraged when we do retreats, as you may do when you do retreats, to read the life stories of the spiritual masters who really, you know, had, you know, this level of dedication to the practice, so. And it can create so much positive, you know, a lot of positive energy for ourselves, give a lot of energy for ourselves for practice. So I think for most of us Tibetan Buddhists, Milarepa's like the one up there in terms of his devotional practice. So I just wanted to share that, since it seems like most of you might not have heard that story before. And that's just a snippet. I mean, there's so many parts in there that are like super, very inspiring. Does anyone have any questions? Comments? Yes?
So, you know, we all live here in Santa Cruz and you know, with our jobs and families.
Yeah.
And if you started going up to the land of medicine or Vajrapani and started such a practice, how does someone whose karma has already led them into you know, say a career and a family and,
yes,
and a few cats at home.
Mm-hmm.
How does one take up Tibetan practice that includes these devotional practices?
Well, we offer many opportunities at our centres to include that in your life, as you do here, I think. So, I mean, most of us, even myself included, as a nun, I don't think I'm ever going to have that kind of devotion that someone like Milarepa has, you know. But nonetheless, it's wonderful, you know, to rejoice in that. But, I mean, at our centres, we have many ways in which one can express one's devotion, you know. First of all, I think the main way is to really study the teachings, you know, in whatever capacity you can. And that's what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says all the time. We can't really have, I think devotion grows through our understanding of the teachings, our appreciation of the teachings, our understanding, studying them, meditating on them, integrating the experiences into our life and seeing that even those few words that the Buddha taught, how much it transforms your life. That's when, to my mind, devotion starts to flower, you know. Because without that, there's no sort of connection, you know. And also, it's not really sincere. So certainly at our centres, although, yes, we have these devotional practices, and, yes, there are people who have actually devoted their life to offering service to Lama Zopa Rinpoche and given up their maybe ordinary life, but we have so many opportunities in our organisation to express your devotion between your other life, or even during your daily life, you know, to transform our mind even when we're doing ordinary activities, you know, like walking and sleeping and talking. Lama Zopa Rinpoche has all these unbelievable ways where we can be mindful in the moment of our motivation, mindful in the moment of remembering our spiritual teacher and his qualities, just for a moment in our life. Or it's particularly in the morning when you wake up, you know, to engage in some moments, some 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes of some kind of devotional practice towards your teacher, towards the teachings instead, in terms of reading and contemplating on the teaching, and then trying to hold that. This is mainly how we encourage people in their daily life, to try and hold that motivation, that feeling of devotion, appreciation, or the, you know, that understanding of the teaching in that moment as you go through your day. And of course, there's opportunities at our centre as they're here to offer service at certain times, to join in different rituals and ceremony. But mainly, I think, this continuity of studying the teachings of the Buddha. That's really the main devotional, studying and integrating that into your life, into your heart, step by step. Does that answer at all? I think, yeah, I don't think it's really any different from what you were, in many ways, and what you're doing here. So the methods are a bit different. What you think, how you meditate, what you meditate on, but how you're integrating it in your daily life is the same. You know, it's just you're maybe just a little bit different using different techniques.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Comments? Yes?
There are a number of, I guess, flavors of Buddhism.
Yes.
Do you select Tibetan Buddhism?
I would have to say probably it's my karma from past life, but I was just very attracted to that from the beginning. I did try. I went to India when I was 20-something, 25, to meditate, and I had no clue about Buddhism, or one of my friends had read some Theravadan Buddhist books, and, you know, she was exploring that, and sounded interesting, so I didn't have any clue really about Buddhism or Hinduism. I just wanted to go to India because I thought that sounds like the place to be, you know, for meditation and spirituality. And so the first course I did out at the Lonely Planet, I saw this Tibetan Buddhist 10-day course, beginner course in meditation and Buddhist teaching, so I was attracted to that. That was very helpful. I tried a little bit from the Burmese tradition a little bit, but it didn't quite fit for my mind somehow. I wasn't, you know, it just wasn't taste, you know, I didn't get some feeling from that. So I just always seemed to move. I've spent 3 years in India and Nepal. When I went to India, I actually ended up spending 3 years and becoming ordained. I didn't plan that. I just planned to go and learn how to meditate and go and do something else. But the plan changed into staying there for 3 years. And I was just always, you know, tried a couple of things. Then I was going to do yoga. and somehow the karma was very strong for me to practice Tibetan Buddhist tradition. It seemed to fit for my mind. I got some experiences from that more quickly than a couple of the other traditions that I tried, or somehow just the connection wasn't there somehow. So for me, I would say it was some karma from past life that drew me there, and I was fortunate enough to, you know, feel that was benefiting my mind quite quickly, that practice, these practices. And just how the teaching, you know, the teachings on the Four Noble Truths were presented in that tradition seemed to fit for my mind. Thank you. Yeah, that's why I feel it's very important, you know, what we're creating now, so important for future lives. This is what we, you know, we talk about a lot in Buddhism. I mean, we know we have future lives. So when I met Buddhism and I had such a, you know, I was fortunate to have quite strong connection quite quickly, I was so grateful to my past lives. Because I was only in my 20s, you know, and I'm like, wow, I'm so lucky I've met this in my 20s, you know. And it helped my life to make sense. So I was very grateful to my past lives, whatever they did. I'm not sure if I'm creating enough for future lives, but I was certainly grateful that you know, I had some sort of something set up so I could meet Buddhism quite quickly this life, and it helped me. Because otherwise, I think my life would have been difficult if I hadn't met Buddhism internally. You know, my mind would have been not able to deal with certain things so easily.
I do yoga.
Yes.
You do, I'm sure.
Yes.
And I wonder if you have any practices specifically geared to the particular, the nine chakras.
Actually, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I do some yoga. I studied yoga just recently, about 2 years ago. I did these 200-hour teacher trainings just to supplement my Buddhist practice, because we don't have a lot of kind of Indian yoga in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition until you get to quite a high level.
Yeah.
So we don't talk a lot about the chakras in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition until you get to kind of higher levels of Tantra, where the mind's much more subtle. And then you're meditating on like subtle movements in the chakras and winds. But it's not easy to get those teachings.
Right.
The emphasis is really around really trying to understand the Four Noble Truths and meditate on that. Because that, you know, and then so we don't tend to go into the subtle body so much.
There's a book now, a new one called Yoga of the Subtle Body.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it from the Tibetan tradition?
Yeah. Well, it's a mix.
It's a mix,
it's
yeah.
A mixture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
T.S. Lowell is the author.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I met him in Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? We've got another few minutes. Comments? Yes?
Yeah, you mentioned the tantric practice.
Yes.
I don't know what tantric practice means.
So in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we have, there's three vehicles. The Buddha taught three what we call vehicles or yanas of teaching. Yanas, the Sanskrit term. Hinayana. Are you familiar with Hinayana, Mahayana,
yeah.
Vajrayana, those expressions? So within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we practice the Hinayana, or lower vehicle. It's the foundational, really. It's really foundational. It's not like it's lesser by any means. It's the foundations of practicing, you know, ethics, ethical discipline. And then the Mahayana teachings, and then the Vajrayana teachings. So the Vajrayana Tantra is this method of which allows one to, what we say, if we practice that method, relying on a spiritual teacher, one can achieve enlightenment more quickly. However, you cannot practice the tantric tradition without a strong foundation in Hinayana and Mahayana teachings that the Buddha taught. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to give up. I'm just going to put those the Hinayana, Mahayana, I'm just on the Vajrayana path. They kind of supplement and complement each other, but without a strong foundation of ethical, you know, very good, strong ethics, and then an understanding of the Four Noble Truths, deep understanding of the Four Noble Truths, supplement that with the Mahayana tradition of embodying this mind of bodhicitta. Use this term, bodhicitta, you know, great compassion, wanting to achieve enlightenment for all sentient beings, dedicated to that mind, you know, that heart, that commitment, then one can engage in what we call tantric teachings. So when you go to places like Land of Medicine Buddha Vajrapani, you see all these deities, you know, and most of them are from the Vajrayana tantric teachings. And we do many, some of them, you know, many of them are very powerful for purification. Even within the Vajrayana teachings, there's different levels of tantra and different levels of empowerment. However, even within empowerment, one has to, you know, rely on a spiritual teacher who can guide you as to when you're ready to take empowerment, when you're ready, you know, you've developed these foundational practices of the Four Noble Truths, understanding that, and also this kind of mind of compassion and bodhicitta. Even if we haven't fully developed it, we've dedicated some wish to benefit others on the path to enlightenment. Then one is kind of what we say suitable or starts to become a vessel to enter into Vajrayana practice. So they each supplement each other. It's not like we're just doing, oh, we're the Tibetan Buddhists and we're just doing Tantra. It's not like that by any means. You know, it's actually you have to have all these three going along at the same time, and that's why it's kind of a little bit complex. There's a lot to take in the first few years because you're trying to kind of step by step get ready for each level of practice, you know. But does that help to answer your question? I mean, I think within the Zen tradition there's also tantric practices. You had some deity practice in some parts of Japan. Any other, maybe we can have 7:25, one more question, if there's someone. Yes?
Are there any books or authors you recommend for introduction?
Introduction to Tantra? Or to... We have many free books at our centre, actually, by Lama Yeshe. He was the founder of our organisation. He was very, very skillful. I mean, these Tibetan Buddhist teachers came from Tibet in very, very strict training in the monasteries. And then, of course, they landed in the West in the late 60s, early 70s. Somehow, Lama Yeshe, Chogyam Trungpa, there were a few great Tibetan masters who were able to come very quickly into the West, understand our culture, and make the teachings fit for our mind. And these very profound teachings, to make simplify them so we could get something out of these Hinayana, Mahayana, you know, just get some essence and get started somehow there, because they spent years studying this. And somehow he was very skillful at sort of condensing and bringing the essence. So we have a website, lamayeshe.com. I'm happy to write it down for you at the end, because you can actually get so much, we have so much material on there that you can just access and read. Land of Medicine Buddha have many free books by Lama Yeshe. There are other great masters as well, but many people, even if they don't stick to our organisation, I've met many people who somehow really benefit from reading Lama Yeshe as an introduction to the Tibetan Buddhist tradition and how it's laid out. He's got one called Becoming Your Own Therapist, and I mean, this was in the 70s he came up with this. It's quite original, you know. And The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism, and Introduction to Tantra. So even if you don't have much background, that one's not for free, but it's called Introduction to Tantra by Lama Yeshe. If you've already been doing some spiritual practice, you'd definitely get some benefit. What are these deities about? What we're trying to do? You're very, very simple way explaining that. So that one would definitely recommend. There's one called Essence of Tibetan Buddhism by Lama Yeshe. That's a free book on, you can download on our website, or you can pick up from Land of Medicine Buddha.
What website is that?
It's called lamayeshe.com.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and many of our books are just on there to download. So, but either way, Lama Yeshe was, it's just LamaYeshe. He was very credible at bringing in, somehow just helping people to connect with Tibetan Buddhism and find what they need right there in that moment, with some often quite profound teaching, but we were able to hear it and understand it and make something of it for our life. He's very, very skillful at that. Unfortunately, he passed away at 49 from a heart problem that he had. But I had never had the opportunity to meet him. He passed away in 1985. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche then was his heart disciple, so he became the director of organisation. Does that help? I guess 7:30. Okay. Thank you.
Buddha's way is unsurpassable.